The Babylon Project was our last best hope for peace. It failed. But in the year of the Shadow War, it became something greater. Our last best hope for victory. The year is 2260. The place, Babylon 5.
Hello and welcome to Chats, the television podcast, season 6, Chatsalon 5. My name is Alan. And I'm joined by the man who is that guy that you see when you leave your bike out and nobody steals it, but you forgot to bring the lock, so it's like, wow, that's so nice. Who was the guy? Or that person who puts like an extra scone in your bag at Starbucks, what? Even though you didn't ask for it. Or that guy who...
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God.
Who scans your bus ticket ahead of you, or scans it, their bus card ahead of whatever, the Metro card, and then they're like, yeah, you can use the turnstile, why not? And you're like, wow, who are you? And then you never see them again. That's Magellan.
You know what, dude? Hi.
What's up? Hi.
I legitimately thought partway through you saying that you were just riffing and forgot that there was something that... lazily written in one of the episodes.
It's so ridiculous. This is Chats on 5. It's a Babylon 5, but it's a TV podcast. This season we talk about Babylon 5. And
if
we watched,
I really, you know, I hope JMS is listening, but I also hope that he understands that we love him
deeply.
Deeply love him. And I poke fun. We poke fun.
Yeah.
I just feel like I started on a bad foot. But like, JMS, it was the whole Justin thing. It wasn't.
No,
was
this ain't it, Chief.
That was not it, Chief. Uh-uh. And you are the Chief. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah, entirely.
You are the Chief. It's just this wasn't it, Chief.
Well, we got to talk about it. So yeah, first we have Season 3, Episode 21, Shadow
Dancing.
The beard
is weird. Sorry.
Yeah, we also watched the finale of season 3, episode 22, Da Hanum.
I wasn't saying first your beard is weird to JMS. I was referencing that Machine Gun Kelly song because he says, let's talk about it, and you said, let's talk about it.
Your beard is weird. Does he say that in that?
I think so. Your weird beard or something.
Yeah.
And then Eminem in his response at the beginning, he's like, your beard is weird. So I have this student, and we say that to each other sometimes.
Do you remember that early chat sim where you were like, I'm this beef?
Yeah, yeah. It is... It is a motif of our show.
They're beef.
Yeah, people don't realize that in the finale of Chats, what's going to happen is Eminem is actually going to hug me closely and stab me in the stomach.
Long live the king.
That's how it's going to end.
Better than Game of Thrones. Wah, 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 wah.
You do the Game of Thrones blues? Is that what you're starting to do?
Blah, 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 blah.
Blah, 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 blah. It sounds like Charlie Brown's parents. Okay, good. Now you can start.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad I can start now.
Now you're allowed to start.
Thank bless.
Bless.
Shadow Dancing and Zaha Doom were the two episodes. Shadow Dancing was written by Jonathan Michael Straczynski, directed by Kim Friedman. It aired October 21st, 1996, and it takes place from December 14th to the 19th of 2260. Magellan, what happened in Shadow Dancing?
In this episode, John Sheridan and Delenn assemble a fleet composed of various alien races and confront the Shadows. Stephen Franklin, still on walkabout, finally finds what he's looking for, though it is not what he expected. Except it is...
Exactly what he expected. ironically, it is exactly.
Yeah. Alan, what'd you think of Shadow Dancing?
Well, in Z-minus 7 days, I'll tell you.
Okay, cool.
They didn't pay that off. Wait a minute.
Good point. Yeah. You're right.
Wait, how does the timeline work? So December 14th, they said Z-minus 7 days. And then, yeah, the 21st of December is when John goes to ZHD. That's fine. Okay. I'm going to start calling it ZHD, by the way, because that's how I call it in my notes.
Cool. We're never going back, so I'm glad you finally come up with a cool nickname the last time we'll ever talk about Zahadoom.
Did they blow the whole planet up?
I have to imagine it's done, right? He dropped a nuke in the core of it.
I thought they just blew up that big temple.
I don't know. Oh, I guess you're right.
If they blew up the whole planet, then we'd just be done.
Yeah,
the
you're
war
right.
would be on.
You're right.
I don't know. But it's Z-minus 7 days. At this point, I was like, we still don't get what this is. Delenn and Sheridan, like you said, are trying to answer your question. Shadow Dancing is fine. I liked the Delenn and Sheridan stuff, sort of. It didn't seem like it was building to anything exciting, though. And then the Franklin stuff is capital D, dumb. Delenn
really?
Sheridan are
so?
Struggling.
You don't like the Franklin stuff?
I mean, I kind of like what he says. I like what I called him Franklin 2 in my notes. Or Franklin. I should call him Franklin. That's what we call him. Franklin. Hey, Franklin. How you doing, Franklin? Franklin is the one that he sees in the down below after he gets fucking stabbed. So, yeah, we have, on one hand, we have the Delenn and Sheridan stuff. Did you get anything out of this plot line that was interesting or memorable? Marcus and Ivanova volunteer, even though they know they only have a 50% survival chance, to go on ahead so that the shadows don't get the jump on them.
Let me be honest with you. I said that I was going to rewatch it for this, and I didn't. Did you?
Who has the time? No, I mean, I watched it. I didn't rewatch it, no.
Yeah. But you watched it the other day, right?
Yeah.
I watched it like maybe a week ago at this point. And the only part of the episode that's sticking in my mind clearly is the Franklin stuff. The Franklin stuff.
Really?
Yeah, really. The rest of it is just kind of like a space fight, whatever.
Yeah, ish.
It seems like, I guess let's talk about Marcus and Ivanova first, because I'm really annoyed that they're just trying to set them up, it feels like. And they keep putting them in plots together, and I don't like that.
And he outright flirts with her in a really dumb way in this, where he does the fake Minbari flirting.
Right. Oh, and it gives the subtitles of, like, you're the most beautiful love creature I've ever seen.
I want to have 17 babies with you. And he's like, it means, I don't know, you're kind of cool, I guess.
But it's weird because, like, in the subtitles, he just says, like, I love you a lot. And then she's like, what did you just say? And he's like, oh, I just said, take my heart with you wherever you go, my love, my sweet love. Mm-hmm. It's just the way they say goodbye. Stupid.
Stop setting them up.
It wouldn't be stupid if I knew that Ivanova would say, actually, you know, I'm flattered, but I'm gay.
Yeah, right.
I'd be fine with that. But you just know that this show is not going to do that. Because we've talked about how JMS had to kind of like mask the Talia Ivanova stuff.
Yeah.
So,
and even though we get a scene where Delenn is like, just open up your heart to me. And Ivanova's like, I loved Talia. And it's like, cool. That was in show. That was canon. And now we're getting this like, will they, won't they? Will the gay girl go out with the handsome guy?
Right.
Like, just stop.
And
just
like,
stop.
Okay. Maybe she's bisexual. We don't need to erase bisexual identity.
Hello.
But it just...
Hello.
But it just doesn't feel like that's how Ivanova was set up for the first two seasons. It felt like it was very clear lesbian subtext.
Yes.
The whole time. And so it feels like kind of a betrayal of that if Marcus is her hot British boyfriend all of a sudden.
Who amongst us doesn't want a hot British boyfriend though? Like, let's be some supremely real. Or be the hot British boyfriend, right?
Yeah.
You know?
Right. So they go to engage. They're trying to test. What are they trying to do? I don't even remember what they're trying to do.
Well, so they're trying to go ahead. This was like a little bit explained at the beginning. They're trying to test like to get the shadows to see them and not the rest of the army. So they're basically a distraction, like an early on distraction.
But they weren't supposed to engage with the shadows. Like,
correct.
Ivanova
it's just to
told,
like get the
like,
targeting
don't,
on them.
Don't fight them. Mm-hmm. And then she fights them anyway and makes like a bad decision. So I don't really understand. I don't remember exactly why they're over there. I think it was just like a scouting thing or something.
Yeah.
I think that's what it was.
basically the two of them want to like have this heroic moment, and they decide to do it together, and then it just is an excuse for them to flirt.
Yeah.
But I mean, all of my notes about the like Sheridan and Delenn stuff talking are like, they're sad that people died in the battle, because they have like a whole scene where they do this whole conflict, and then they're like, we did it, we succeeded, we defeated so many shadows, but people died, and that's bad. And it's like, yeah, I know that's bad. I'm not like telling you it's not bad that real lives are lost in war, but like, you are the two heads of an army,
right? I mean, I will say that I think the moments where I'm the most invested in these battles are where they set up just beforehand people being like, okay, I'm gonna help you, but like, this better work out.
Mm-hmm.
So when Jakar is like, we don't want to risk our Narn ships, and then they send the Narn ships to help in the other episode from before, mm-hmm. I was certain that like that Narn ship was going to get blown up or something.
Right.
It was going to cause a huge rift and situation. So in this episode where the Drazi guys, like, I'm doing my best, but like the Drazi are a really weird society. So what am I supposed to do? And then the Drazi ships start getting attacked. I don't care about the Drazi, but I was like really invested in the fact that the Drazi had been like, we don't need to be in this fight. This isn't really our fight. In the long run, it's probably in our best interest. But like, we're going out on a limb to help you guys. And so it's moving to me to see them in that fight and like getting killed.
Right.
More moving than like seeing a Minbari ship blow up.
Yeah, it's the context that matters. I mean, hey man, the Drazi are the same people that had the color wars. Remember the purple and the greens?
Yep. Yeah, yeah.
That was the Drazi also. So who's more memorable? Color Wars or the cool faction? Speaking of Jakar and stuff, there's that great line early on. May God stand between you and harm in all the empty places where you must walk. I just love hearing Andreas Katsula speak. It makes me very happy when he says these fancy things, even if they don't make a lot of sense.
Yeah.
We were just reading a quote from John Updike and staring at it for like 5 minutes, being like, what does that act? What does that mean?
Yeah.
And Jakar definitely channels that sort of energy of like a writer who knows how things feel but doesn't know how to make them make sense.
Yeah. I appreciated the nuance of going back to what you were saying about John kind of hand-wringing over who died.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a little more nuanced than that, because what he's ultimately saying is like they needed a big win just from a morale standpoint, and they got a kind of win.
Exactly.
It was cool that they destroyed so many shadow ships, but they got a bunch of their dudes blown up in the process. So I think it was more than just him performing guilt of like, there's blood on my hands.
And then the other thing with the Delenn and Sheridan stuff is it's supposed to set up that they've gone through this together, they've developed an attraction to each other that's more than just respect. It's gone into love, it's gone in, and there's this other aspect to their scenes that I found really off-putting. It's the whole Delenn sleeping ritual.
Yeah, it feels like here's what it feels like. We've known that Delenn and Sheridan are moving towards being together for a while now.
Yep.
We've known ever since he saw her hair for the first time and was like, whoa, who's that? Who's that ambassador on this council that I'm supposed to be a part of? Yeah. Ooh, look at that ambassador. That
somebody get me that bone official number.
Ooh, yeah. You made that up?
Mm-hmm.
That's good.
Thank you.
So we've known it since then.
Oh my god, I didn't get it until you just said it. Oh shit, I shouldn't say that. I did it on purpose.
Wait, what?
I didn't get bone number until I said it out loud, and then I realized that it was funny. I was just saying words.
Why did you say it?
Because it was funny.
How could you possibly string together those words?
I fell into a play on words. Nope, I fell into a play on words. Well, I knew like bone thing she has. Yeah.
No.
Whatever.
Way.
Let's.
No
every
way.
Second this that is, we talk about this,
it gets
less
plausible. This is implausible.
Yeah. I have to cut everything where we talk about this out. It has to.
No. Why?
Because the kids need to think I'm clever.
You were clever. You were.
Okay, then. Thank you. Thank you, Dad.
You're welcome, son. Okay, so we've known for a while that Delenn and Sheridan are going to be together. And I think my sense is that JMS also knew that he wanted to have the Anna plot happen at the end of season 3. And somewhere here at the end, he was like, oh, crap. We need to get Delenn and Sheridan on the cusp of being intimate so that Anna returning hits harder.
Yeah, exactly. That's, I mean, just the fact that she's like, and I'm going to stay awake for the whole thing is like,
yeah.
The cynical view of it is like, did you guys really make a religious ceremony so that she would be awake when Anna comes in? Like, did you do that?
Right.
I know
so
they
that
didn't,
she would be awake and John wouldn't.
And John like, wouldn't, exactly.
The alternative is what? That they're like having sex or something and she's like, hello, John. Oh my. Like something stupid like that.
Exactly. Yeah. No good things.
So it felt, you know, we talked last episode when we were talking about And the Rock Cried Out, No Hiding Place, that it kind of felt like Delenn was being characterized differently than she had been. She was being very jokey, very flirty, like kind of silly. In ways that aren't unprecedented for Delenn. We've seen her act like that in snippets, in bursts before, but that was kind of a concentrated span of that last episode. And so now this episode, that all it also feels like it's being forced a little bit. It just kind of, yeah, it felt odd that after the big battle, she was like, hey, so I think it's time that we like go to bed with each other. And John's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Okay. My, my, my. And she says, no, not like that. Which,
you horny man.
Which it is like that, though, because the point of the ritual is to decide if it's cool to fuck.
Yeah. So, it's like, we're going to do this three times and then we can do it naked.
Right. So I don't know, but I didn't mind the sleeping ritual thing. I mean, it felt weird in the way that Minbari are weird.
Mm-hmm.
That you are, when someone's sleeping, you see their true face. Like, okay, sure. That sounds like other Minbari bullshit. So I was cool with that. It's just, yeah, it was clearly designed for the
snow globe moment.
For the snow globe moment, yeah.
Oh boy, yeah. Anna walks in and it's like, hi, I'm Anna. John's wife, and he's like, for the viewer, basically to be like, who the fuck?
Remember, you saw me once
for 3 seconds. Yeah. I like the part where she's walking onto the station and it's in first person, and Zach Allen's like, whoa, who's that? Like, doesn't say anything,
yeah,
but everyone's just
that
like,
was cool.
Yeah, who's this person? And then it's just a lady. Yeah, they're definitely just kind of leading right into the finale with that. But the Franklin stuff we still have not talked about is worth discussing.
Yeah, let's do it.
So Franklin finishes his walkabout this week.
Mm-hmm.
He finally finds himself. The first thing he does, though, is he has this like really heavy-handed like homelessness parable where this like affluent white family walks by and they're like, oh, there's no more homeless on earth. Why would they not here? That's not a homeless man. He's just mistaken. He has problems. We mustn't be near him.
And then it's like, oh, Janie, don't touch that man. You don't know where he's been.
Literally, you don't know where he's been. And it's like, you guys legitimately made the one person of color on your show the homeless like character. That's fine. I mean, do it. Do it, you cowards. And then they did it. It's a charged image is what I'm saying. Is this like this black man is being insulted by a white family, and it's like, you guys are you clearly know what you're doing, but it's just very heavy. The mom's name is Barbara. That's how you know that they're rich. is that she's a Barbara. So there's that stuff. And then he kind of goes off on his own. He sees some guy getting beat up in the down below.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, I'm a doctor. I need to save him, because he still doesn't fucking understand that he's not his job. And he goes in and that guy doesn't get away. And then they're like, oh, another guy? Yoink. And he gets stabbed in the stomach.
Yeah.
Which is like one of the most actually real life violent things we've seen in this show.
Yeah, it's pretty gruesome.
Mm-hmm. And the guy he saved is just like, peace, thanks, bye.
Yeah, he's like, ah, sorry. And we see him go through this process of, ah, I should. Oh, no, I can't. No, ooh, I really, no, sorry, dude. All right, yeah. Well, I'll see you, man. Thanks for the saving.
Good luck. Yeah, thanks for the saving. Take it easy. Take it easy. What is it? Yeah, and then he is like bleeding out on the floor, and this is when Franklin comes up to him. And I love that Franklin is like motivational, but also like very mean.
I found it kind of dumb.
Yeah.
I don't know. I was conflicted about the Franklin stuff. It's super memorable, and yeah, it's a cool thing to actually see happen. Mm-hmm. To talk about the walkabout is like, I'm going to meet myself. And you, as a viewer, you go, okay. But then you actually see it happen. It was also engaging to watch Richard Biggs do both at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Like be the jerk and be the like, I'm dying.
I'm bleeding out. I want to live, dude.
Can you stop being so mean to me? But
he's just getting bullied by himself. I can relate.
I just feel like Franklin walks away from this with just the wrong take.
Well, what do you consider his take? Because his line at the end is, I can define myself by what I am and what I'm not. And then Sheridan's like, and what are you? And he says, alive, and everything else is negotiable. So he has, but what that means is he developed like a value for life, and he understands that being alive in itself is a good thing, and it's worth like being satisfied with just being alive.
Yes, but that's one thing.
Yeah.
But it doesn't, it feels like the bulk of his self-criticism is around him running away from things. That's mm-hmm. principally what he's criticizing himself for. He says, like, you ran away from medical school, you ran away from this army job. And then he kind of lumps in, like, during the Earth Mimbari War, you took your Mimbari records and you destroyed them, as if that was an example of him running away, which didn't make sense.
Right.
And then he's like, your job was a way to run away from yourself. The drugs are a way to run away from your job.
Right. Vicious cycle, et cetera, et cetera.
And I'm just not convinced that is the problem.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Or at least it doesn't feel like, at the end, Franklin's like, okay, I know what I got to do. I got to go back to being a doctor because I'm running away.
Right.
And this whole walkabout thing was really about running away.
Mm-hmm.
But like what we were talking about in the episode where he meets that lady who singing lady, is that part of his problem is that he's just kind of pompous and thinks that he knows what's best for people.
Right.
And is always trying to like cure people and treat people when it's not his business, or where he needs to like defer to others. And he needs to be more humble. That to me seems like the issue. Like his issue with drug abuse, ultimately part of the problem is that Garibaldi was like, bro, I have been through this before. I can help you. And Franklin was like, no, screw you. I'm not going to listen to you. And like at the height of his meltdown, part of his issue was that he was berating and yelling at the people in the med lab.
And we're trying to help him. And
yeah. And the reason that he was doing all these stims is because he felt like he had to be the guy who was on 24/7 and like didn't mm-hmm. trust anybody else to do the work.
Yeah.
So to me, his problem isn't running away. His problem is kind of a similar problem to John Sheridan's problem of like, you've got to trust the people around you. And, like, you've got to let go of you being the dude and you being the main ego. And it just feels like Franklin's coming back into Med Lab and he's like, I'm not running away anymore. And then the way that they show us that he's not running away anymore is he turns to this woman and he's like, who taught you how to insert a tube thingy? Oh, you're so bad at this.
Yeah, it's like, that's not, no, you guys missed it.
Yeah. So, I don't know. It just feels like he learned the wrong lesson.
I think it's partly a problem of, like, if this show had more time, his walkabout would have gone longer, and he would have been, like, again, maybe have another challenge where he's like, no, not only do I need to, like, redefine myself and not define mm-hmm. myself by my work, but I need to accept help and know when I'm not right.
Yes, that's what it is, like, he's the helper doctor, but mm-hmm. he needs to be able to be helped.
Know when you have a problem and know that other people can help you fix it. Trust in the process. All that stuff.
Yeah. That's his problem.
So it is frustrating. I agree.
And it just felt like running away from responsibility was kind of a, like, boilerplate self-diagnosis that didn't really feel, like, accurate mm-hmm. to what he had going on.
Yeah, the hallucination says, take responsibility for your actions, for crying out loud. You go in there and you fight for what matters to you. Don't just walk away because it's easier. And it's like, that's not, I don't think that was the problem, you guys.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's frustrating, but it's, again, well performed. Like,
yeah,
sincerely, and very memorable.
And the way it's shot is, like, it's not easy to have shots where it's the same guy talking to himself. And to have, like, motion in those shots and
right
to make sure they're composed in a way that works. So there's a lot of craft going into those scenes. And I think the dialogue is even good. It's mm-hmm. just that the overall premise that his character flaw was that he was running away doesn't fully feel accurate. Like, it feels like that's maybe a symptom of certain things, or it is a problem, but it is not the problem that he needs to reckon with most urgently.
Preach it to the choir. Preach it to the people who also could take this advice, myself included.
Yeah, me too.
That's the thing I like about Franklin's plot, and I've liked about him since season one, is, like, I don't like that I can relate to him, but I appreciate that I feel represented in some way. Like, this person who, like, sees their problem and tries to fix it and honestly Fs up repeatedly.
Yeah.
But that's, like, that's the process is the, that's the fun. That's the journey.
He kind of feels in the crew like he's the Batman character. Like, he's the one guy who's just actually a normal dude
mm-hmm.
who just made himself pretty buff and has some cool stuff. And he's hanging out with, like, Superman and whatever. But he's, like, the most human guy.
I'm not saying if Babylon...
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, if Babylon 5 was the Justice League... Then
yeah, we're going to have the conversation that they had at the end of the King Arthur episode. What about the Justice League?
How do we fit Arthurian legend? That's broke. What about, you know what's woke? Which one of them is the different cast of Yo Gabba Gabba? Here we go!
But if I'm both the Wonder Twins...
Then who is Lady Diana?
Yeah.
Oh boy. I mean, that is what I have for Shadow Dancing. I want to dig into this finale, but before we do,
yeah,
I would also enjoy reading some emails with you, sir.
Oh, I would love that.
We get the best emails, man. We got two this week. Emails.
Ooh, yay! I always love when there's enough for both of us to read.
So two or more.
Yeah.
Hold on. Counts on fingers. Yes. This first one's from Dan. Can we start calling, instead of fan mail, we'll call his emails Dan mail.
Dan mail, yeah, that's great.
Yeah, I love it. So this is a Dan mail. And they say, Londo's machinations in this episode. This is about And the Rock Cried Out, No Hiding Place, by the way.
Oh, dang.
Darn, I thought it was about Shadow Dancing.
No, I wanted to read the Dan email about
the Rock. You can read the Dan mail.
I love reading Dan's emails.
Read the Dan mail. I'll read the other one.
You sure?
Yes, I'm sure with more certainty than anything else.
I mean, they're both good. It's just when I read Dan's emails, it always makes me feel like I'm smart. I agree, I'm coming up with it.
Yeah, so smart.
Okay. You want to trade paragraphs?
I feel sure. Better.
All right, go ahead.
Fuck yeah.
We'll do it for both.
Okay, all so right. I'll go first. Londo's machinations in this episode are troubling, whether or not Londo has gone full evil, or is trying to play some sort of long game with the shadows. Mm-hmm. He still uses Veer in a dangerous way that results in Veer being kidnapped, beaten, and psychically violated. He appeals to Jakar's one remaining weak spot by using him in exchange for the relief of some of the Narn people and offering up the head of the Centauri most directly responsible for the bombing of Narn. That is a bombing, by the way, that Londo cannot claim to have no part of. He uses people, including his one remaining friend, in a very cold and calculating way that doesn't feel like a good direction for Londo's soul.
Yeah. I think the jury's still out, but it doesn't seem good.
Nope.
Chronologically, this was the first kiss between Delenn and Sheridan, head waggy as it was. But it wasn't the first time that we've seen them kiss. Back in War Without End, Sheridan had that future flash where future him and future Delenn kissed while in that Centauri holding cell. That kiss wasn't as animated. That's a good point.
Yeah, I love the Looney Tunes episode of Babylon 5. God, remember that part of Farscape where they didn't animate it?
What a fun show that was.
What a good show. People should watch that. If only there was a podcast that watched all of it for the first time.
I know, and did a podcast, yeah.
Yeah, when they were
that
in college.
That would actually be great.
Yeah. I can't claim to be an expert in Centauri politics, but I don't know that Lord Janno was saying that Minister Verini was advocating that the only solution to end the fighting between House Rifa and Malari was murder. That's just where Londo and Rifa immediately took it, touched by evil as they both are. In fact, Janno seemed quite annoyed that it ended in death, even if that death supposedly exposed a traitor. And while Lord Janno accepted the outcome, he didn't seem to fully believe it or be particularly happy about it. That is a simple answer to a complicated question. I say that as a compliment, because we were saying, you know, what was the goal of telling them you guys need to stop fighting?
Mm-hmm.
Because both of them took it as like, okay, so win. And that means that you guys actually instigated more fighting.
But it just seems naive on the part of Lord Janno to mm-hmm. like think that they would be like, oh, okay, well,
I guess now. I can't anymore.
Yeah. In talking about scenes that are discordant between violent visuals and cheerful music, it wasn't a In talking about scenes that are discordant between violent visuals and cheerful music, it wasn't a widely used trope back when B5 chose to do it, and quite a few people found it surprising. But it wasn't completely unheard of. The first example that I can think of is with the 1971 movie adaptation of A Clockwork Orange. Oh, that's a good point.
Yeah, yeah.
The main character Alex and his gang break into a home to beat, rape, and God knows what, an older couple, and as this all unfolds, he starts singing the song, Singing in the Rain, even beating the husband in timing with the verse at one part, and it's actually quite an upsetting juxtaposition. I liked it in B5, but it wasn't nearly as upsetting.
Yeah, it's definitely not upsetting in B5, too, because they're killing Lord Rifa. So it's like a nice, like, it makes you kind of satisfied.
Yeah.
But, yeah, this is a thing where, when I asked, like, how far back does this go historically, there are so many answers in film that go really far back, between Hitchcock and Charlie Chaplin and Clockwork Orange and all that stuff. But, like, television history is so much cloudier because such a large portion of at least American television history was not like very artistically inclined works. It was like single camera sitcoms and like family shows and game shows and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But like there was smart, like creative television in like the 50s and 60s. And I'm sure some of it used music in this clever way that we really like. So that is kind of where I want my final answer for like what is the earliest example of soundtrack dissonance, but
mm-hmm.
Definitely Clockwork Orange has that is a very powerful scene.
Yeah.
Dan concludes, back in the day there was a lot of confusion about where the Triluminary came from and whether or not it was some sort of bootstrap paradox. It's my favorite underground indie band, by the way. They're playing at the Middle East next week. To clear up the confusion, JMS said on the message boards that the Triluminary comes from Epsilon 3 with Zathras. Comes up from Epsilon 3 with Zathras, goes back in time with Zathras and Valen, and that it is this Triluminary that Valen had that's held by the Grey Council and given to Delenn. Oh my god, so it's cyclical because then she gives it to Sinclair, and then he takes it back.
No, no, no. He's saying that it was on. It starts on Epsilon 3.
Oh, so Epsilon 3 to Zathras, to Valen, to the Grey Council, back to Epsilon 3. Does it loop back
then
around?
It's given to Delenn, and she gives it to
Sinclair.
I don't know.
This is hard stuff. How did the Great Council give him to Delenn? This whole thing also dispels another bit of Minbari metaphysics besides the end of Valen's prophecies. It also tidies up the notion of what the Triluminary detects. It doesn't detect some spiritual intermingling of Minbari and human souls, but rather it detects Sinclair / Valen's DNA, including it being passed down to his descendants, Delenn being one of them.
What?
Right, because he's the first. So if
they... The first what? He's not the first Minbari.
But she's his ancestor, or descendant, rather.
How did you know that?
Because Dan said it.
Yeah, I think Dan just spoiled that. Dan?
Oh, are we not supposed to know that?
I don't know. I don't know how we would have known that.
I'm confused.
That's crazy.
Anybody can just jump in and clarify. We don't have to wait to hear that. But I don't want to look into that because that's like tricky.
Yeah.
Anyways, thank you. I think somebody had also mentioned. Yep, Merv, recent Twitter commenter, had said the Triluminary originated on Epsilon 3. If you want to read the full explanation, go to the Lurker's Guide page for World Without End, Episode 2. The scene that made that clear got cut. That must be where this is coming from.
Okay.
Thank you, Merv, by the way. Merv has been commenting a lot recently and being very helpful.
I get it. Cool.
We have this other email from our friend Nick.
I'll just read this whole one.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. It's short. Nick says, "Hey, guys. Great job passing the test on the bribe." Okay, nice. "My Patreon donations are now officially called the Donation of the Light, and no need to bring out a frozen Jack the Ripper to test further." That's
bless. Cute.
"I don't have much else to add about the last episode other than to say how much I liked the gray motivation and behavior of Londo. It's just so interesting and well executed." And then Nick says, "Currently catching up on your Newsroom season. It's too long ago I saw Pushing Daisies, but I might eventually do that. While it's not my main podcast app, any reason I cannot find your show on Google Play Music's podcast section, or am I being thick? Thanks, Nick." Nick, just so you know, it's good to be thick now.
It's, yeah, now you can add as many C's to the end of that as you want.
Yeah, you actually want to be really thick. do you have to request to be on Google Play, you think?
So I was almost certain I had done that when, like, not when we started, but recently I had done that.
Yeah.
And then when we got this email, I triple checked and resubmitted it. So if it's still not there, I might have to figure some stuff out because the back end for putting podcasts on Google Play is a little annoying, but I will do my best.
Cool.
Because we have an RSS feed. It should just be like iTunes is, where you give them an RSS feed and then they check it and then you're good. But they had some other stuff that was like, you need your website link to be in the RSS feed or whatever. And I'm like, guys, I use Simplecast. Please be chill. Whatever. Back end stuff. I am trying to get it on Google Play Music. But so you're not incorrect in that assumption. And yeah, the donation stuff still makes me laugh. But alas, that's going to do it for our first episode discussion. We will be right back to discuss the season 3 finale, Zahadoom.
Welcome back to Chatsalon 5. The second episode we watched this week was Season 3, Episode 22. 22. The second episode we watched this week was Season 3, Episode 22, Zahadoom. It was written by J. Michael Straczynski, directed by Adam Nimoy. It aired October 28th. 1996. And it takes place on December 19th through 25th of 2260. Alan, what happened in Zahadum?
The best thing about podcasting and liking talking and listening to your own voice is that in my head, the reason I'm laughing is because I keep thinking of different ways to like say what JMS stands for. Like Jumbo Mumbo Stumbo. Like, that's so funny to me, but somebody's listening to that like, what the fuck? Talk about the show, you children. I'm like, no, Jumbo Mumbo Stumbo. That's the writer.
Every week that I am about to say JMS, I think, okay, this is the time where I come up with a good one. And then I just say it. I just say his name.
Joseph. This one's written by Joe.
This one's written by Justin.
We'll get there. In this episode, okay. John Sheridan. Okay, John Sheridan. No, it's okay. John Sheridan.
Good. No, go for it. It's your go. It's your turn. Stage is yours.
Jonathan Sheridan goes to Zahadum with... Oh, my God. Lord have mercy. He goes with his wife, Anna, who has apparently returned from the dead. While there on Zahadum, he makes the ultimate sacrifice to hold back the threat of the shadows. Magellan, what did you think of the season 3 finale? I have my hands on my hips and it's improving my tone.
I was underwhelmed by it. We were talking before the record, or we were about to start talking about this, and then I nobody knows what you're referring to. When we start our records, I always go bow to check if my microphone's working. So that's what he's referencing. Before we started recording, we were talking about how about cork. Cork. Oh, I hope people have listened to the newsroom.
Yeah, Nick's saying he's listening to the newsroom one right now. So yeah, there you go. He'll catch up.
Yeah, at least he'll get it. We were talking about how it feels like these pair of episodes is not a great season ender.
Nope.
And then we were wondering, is that kind of just how Babylon 5 has been up to this point? Because I do remember being underwhelmed by season 1. Mm-hmm. With the final shot being Sinclair going like, oh yes, the lady that I like, now we're lying down together or something. But I don't remember how season 2 ended.
So season two was the fall of night. It ends with the TV broadcast being like, yeah, so what's the fuck's the guy's name who we hate? Oh, Warren Keffer. It's like, yeah, Warren Keffer's footage got out, and this is like the first image of the shadows. That's the last part of season two.
Right. Well, what's the rest of the but the rest of the episode
Kosh
is like Kosh
shows his whole nut.
His true nut. Yeah. That was actually pretty cool. I liked seeing Kosh's nut.
Yeah.
But the last episode was a sort of denouement after rest of the season. Oh no, and the fucking second to last episode of season two is Comes the Inquisitor.
Oh yeah, what a messy what are you guys doing?
Yeah. Babylon 5, like they do the whole Centauri Narn conflict and it's sick as fuck.
Yeah.
And then they end on like, and now it's Jack the Ripper and here he comes to interview you in a scary way. Oh no. God damn.
And the kids keep telling us like, I'm not going to do an impression of the listeners. That's mean. They're like, season 4 is good. No more filler. And it's like, it's not, the problem isn't that Zahadum or Shadow Dancing are filler. They're basically not filler. I mean, the Franklin stuff is character development and it's not like plot development, but I don't consider that filler. It's just that Zahadum is like asking questions and then not giving us answers that I wanted. So it's kind of like the show is going in a direction I'm not happy with. But I don't consider that bad. What I do consider bad is John Sheridan, like jumping off of a planet and us supposed to think that that's like a heroic death. Here's the cool thing about this episode. I want to talk about a positive thing before we kind of like dig into the bad performances.
Yeah, I mean, it's good. Like, I think our bar is just set at a certain place for Babylon 5. What's funny? Go ahead. What are you laughing at?
Bar.
That's how I talk.
No, I know. It's literally not about how you... It's just words are funny. Like, I'm so tired right now.
Okay.
All words are funny.
Yeah,
all right. No, the thing that's funny... Fuck. The thing that's good about this episode is John going to Zahdoom, and you're like, no, John, you know this is bad. This is bad character development. Like, this is negative progression for you, man.
Yeah.
Why would you believe Anna? And then the end of the episode is him being like, I never believed her. Not for one second did I think this was my wife.
My wife.
My one wife is Dylan, and her bone number is what I call when I need to ask her.
555. Stare at me sleeping.
Yeah. Whisper me sweet nothings before bed. So it's like, okay, so John's a little bit clever, but then he jumps off of the cliff. Like, what is that? What was the purpose of that?
Yeah, I have mixed feelings about that being the good part of the episode, because literally two episodes ago, the plot hinged on, uh-oh, what's Londo doing? Oh, it seems like things are going a weird way. Oh, he had a secret plan that he reveals at the end. And now we're doing that again with John. Feels kind of repetitive and takes the punch out of John doing this surprising thing where he reveals that he knew the whole time mm-hmm. what was going on. Mm-hmm. What I really wanted out of going to Zahdoom was for the shadows to be convincing in some way. Because we're ripe for, like, we were ending season two with, huh, kind of weird that, like, Kosh looks like Jesus down there, huh? Mm-hmm. Pretty manipulative that the Vorlons have created, like, the religions of all these different other races. So I'm ready for someone to tell me, bro, the Vorlons are fucked up. They're not the good guys. They've just defined what you perceive to be good as being them.
Isn't that fucked up? And you're like, yeah. So what, are you guys the good guys? And they're like, all right, so here's our ethos.
So we believe that... We believe that social Darwinism,
right,
the philosophy of 1800s capitalists, actually applies to space. And you're like, oh, no.
There's no good. There's no good. And it's not like I need a good alien. It's just like, if the show is going to be about the humans versus the shadows, like, forget the Vorlons. The Vorlons guided us. They are the reasons we're in this conflict. Yes. And they're pushing us in the right direction. But humans versus shadows. I need to know what the shadows' motive is and why we're fighting against it. Other than, it's bad. I need something. I need some meat. And this is conveyed to us through three very, in my opinion, very poor performances. You have Bruce Boxleitner's actual IRL wife at the time playing Anna, which is fun.
Oh, interesting.
You have this guy. We have Morden, who definitely takes a step back in performance, because Ed Wasser, I think, plays really well when he is speaking one-on-one with somebody and able to, like, whisper sweet nothings to you and kind of, like, yeah, trick you and all that manipulative stuff. That's great. I love Morden as that. Morden as, like, the third guy in, like, a group conversation.
Yeah.
Yeah. War is good, Sheridan. You'd have to... Don't you get it? Do you want to buy my tweet suit?
Not cool anymore.
And then you have fucking Justin. Justin. I texted Michelle this morning as I was walking into work. I was like, we were joking about how, like, I'm the ancient brilliant man named Justin, and maybe that's clever because he's a human and it's 2260, so like 200 years ago they had people named Justin. And Michelle's like, that's not cool. That isn't a cool thing that they did.
It's not good.
It's like you said Greg the Time Wizard.
Right, exactly. I really wanted Sheridan to, like, talk to a big scorpion. And for him to be like, this big scorpion's making a lot of sense. Actually, I kind of like this big scorpion.
I kind of love the Scorpio, yeah.
I kind of am in love with the scorpion. And instead we just got, like, the guy who didn't make it through the callbacks of the James Bond villain auditions.
Bah!
Describing, again, like, natural selection, sort of. And then being like, eh, what do you think? And Sheridan going, no, I don't. I'm like, Earth has already decided this is not good
mm-hmm.
as a worldview. And I just think this Justin adds nothing. He adds nothing whatsoever. And it is kind of less interesting to me to think that the Shadows have like a team of humans.
Yeah.
That is so much less interesting to me than Morden being the one guy who they have do this stuff.
Right. If they just have agents that they pulled from whenever people like flew near Zahadum, then that sucks. That's just like, so you guys have humans because they can't have like their own representatives. They don't want to make the scorpions talk or the ships talk. So instead they just have people. There's trivia about Justin that really frustrates me, actually.
Okay.
I don't know what this is cited from, but it's on the Babylon 5 wiki, because this is the only appearance of Justin. He does not come back.
Yeah, I believe it.
Justin is intended to be Sheridan's equal and opposite. Rather than a popular war hero from the front lines, he's a quiet man that nobody knows of who works behind the scenes. Both men enjoy a fondness for tea, which they claim helps them sleep. That is when I'm in English class and the teacher is like, please write more about this character from of Mice and Men.
Because like there was a whole thing about how he's going to meet his equal and opposite or whatever.
Yeah, the man in between from back in All Alone in the Night where Kasha's like, you're going to meet the guy.
Oh.
And it's like, this is your opposite? Is just an old guy? Like, what are you doing? It feels very wrong, like poorly planned. I don't know. That's what bummed me out about this episode. Not just the
and
justice.
It's also
like
the fulfillment of the prophecy, isn't that sad or whatever, isn't that satisfying?
Yes, yes.
Because it's like, okay, the man in between, what could that mean? And then Justin's like, hey, you know, I'm a middleman.
Come on.
Bing, bing, bing. I'm the man in between. It's so dumb. And like, Morden already was that. He was already that. Morden was already Sheridan's equal and opposite, like a deserter, a traitor, a manipulative, shadowy, evil guy.
Yeah, who has people like work for him instead of working
with people. Just as handsome as Sheridan is, you know? Like, Morden was already that. You didn't need to make this new dude to be that. And none of that reads. Like, I didn't read that as, oh, this is the guy who was being talked about. I didn't read him at all as Sheridan's equal and opposite. Like, you could also read some of that stuff as talking about his wife, right? Like, the other hand is like, there's that shot lingering on her ring.
Oh, right.
Like,
right.
That's what the other hand thing was. And like, maybe she's his equal and opposite. She's like another Sheridan, right? Because they both are named Sheridan. So I think there are ways that you could have made that the thing. But the fact that it's just like a dude who's Sheridan's like, who are you? And he's like, well, you know how the weather's weird sometimes?
Yeah.
That's me.
Yeah.
Stupid.
But he literally, I don't have the exact quote, but what he's basically saying is like, everything that you take for granted in life that you say like, oh, somebody handles that, like the value of currency, that's, I work with those people. And it's like, that's...
But what does that even mean?
What do you mean? What are those words you just said? Why'd you say that? And then you have Anna, who we can briefly talk about Anna Sheridan as well, because these are all the different like tent poles of...
Yeah, I just want to say one more thing about the scene.
Yeah.
It's just that I really strongly believe that it would have been 10 times better if it was just Morden.
Yeah.
If Sheridan shows up and he's like, what the fuck? This is Morden. And Anna's like, oh, yeah, Morden's awesome.
Yeah, love Morden. What are you talking
about?
I
fucking love
this
guy. Sometimes we kiss each other on the cheek just for fun. And then she's like, come here, Morden. Give me a cheek kiss. And he's like, oh, okay, why?
Okay, baby,
you know. Like that kind of thing.
You're right. So then the problem with Anna is like, you bring your dead like wife onto the show. I want to see what your relationship was like when you guys were married. Because we don't know. All we know is that they were married and they loved each other and they were like science people. But we don't have any basis in their relationship to say like, oh, we think something seems off. Because all we know is that Sheridan at the end goes, you know, you have her voice and her face, but not her personality. And it's like,
right.
I didn't know what her personality was. I only know that because it's like blaringly obvious because Melissa Gilbert is playing this character like a robot.
Mm-hmm.
and just being like, come on, be cool, just work with the shadows. I love them. John, my husband. Like,
right.
If this performance was believed, because what's wild too is like Boxleitner really brings it in the beginning when he first sees her and he's like choked up.
Oh, it's brutal.
It's such a good performance. And he's like, oh my God, how are you alive? And he starts to, it seems like he starts to believe this whole thing about Delenn lied to you. Delenn knows more than she's talking about. Her and Kosh are always pushing you in the wrong direction. I just wanted to show you that we can make progress happen. That's what we always wanted, John. We're science people. We're earthlings. We want progress. We want progress. Yeah.
And you want him to believe that for a little bit.
Yeah.
You want him to be mad at Delenn and to lose faith in the mission mm-hmm. for a little bit. Mm-hmm. And it seems like he's doing that. But then by the end of the episode, it's like, oh, no. I never lost faith. I still love you, Delenn. Like, yeah, I was a little mad. Whatever. But he was really angry. He said that he didn't think he'd ever be able to trust her again.
Right.
Beautiful scene,
yes.
By the way.
Like, yes.
Really honest and wrenching scene where you watch Delenn be like, yeah, I fucked up. There's nothing I can do.
I don't have an answer for you. Sorry.
Like, yeah, I probably wouldn't have told you if I knew for sure that your wife was alive.
Yeah. I think the adjective I'd use to describe this finale is hasty.
Mm, yeah.
Because, like, let's just even break down what happens after this. So he talks about how he doesn't believe Delenn anymore. He's frustrated. Anna finally convinces him to come to ZHD. He goes there. He has a conversation with Hermord and Justin. They tell him about the shadows. He says, huh, sounds good. Actually, it doesn't sound good. Actually, it sounds bad. Here's a gun. Shoot, shoot, shoot. And then the White Star comes and saves him, but like crashes and drops a nuke on the planet. And then he jumps off because a voice that sounds like Kosh tells him to jump. He jumps. Ivanova panics because she has force power. I guess she does. She literally does have force powers. Wait a minute. That's why she was like, I sense that somebody died.
Yeah, her psychic.
That actually, okay, that answered one of my questions. So she's worrying like, oh God, I think Sheridan died. Everyone's freaking out. And then they're like, by the way, Garibaldi's gone. Because it's a season finale, and it wouldn't be a season finale of Babylon 5 if Garibaldi didn't disappear. This is now a thing. Yeah. To the point where I believe the second episode of next season is called Whatever Happened to Mr. Garibaldi, because they know that. So it just felt like, we got to get everyone to the place, like, and places, let's get to there, and here we go. Let's get ready for season 4. And it felt very rushed in that way.
Yeah, and I think there are ways to do episodes like that where a ton of shit happens that feel like, oh my God, that episode was nuts. A ton mm-hmm. of shit happened. Mm-hmm. But when there are enough elements that unravel, the whole thing doesn't feel as strong. Mm-hmm. So like the Justin thing, it's just silly. That his wife thing, it doesn't ever at any point feel believable. Like you can kind of see him being brought along, but you as a viewer are never fooled by it.
Right.
Because she's here and she's like, okay, so let's go to Zahadum, right? Should we go? Just as I was starting to think, like, okay, all the tests work out, she's here, whatever, immediately she says, let's go to Zahadum. And as a viewer, you know, okay, she's like, whatever, she's evil.
And Franklin drops the medical thing early on. That's like she has the same thing in her brain as Catherine did. The woman that was like Bester's lover.
Yeah, you don't know that. I guess you could infer that from the scans. But he tells John early enough that John can plausibly say that he never planned to go to Zahadum before he knew that.
Right. So John knew very early on and still goes because he's trying to learn about the enemy. You know, this kind of ties back into like last episode.
Well, he's
last
not
week.
Trying to learn about he's trying to blow the enemy up.
With bombs.
Yeah.
But going there to be like, all right, well, let's hear them out. What do they think is their plan? And, like, confirming that it's bad, all it does for us is create, like, a clear-cut villain, which I don't need. This is not a show that needs clear-cut villains. It needs more Londos mm-hmm. and more Rifas, people who have complicated histories and difficult reasons for the things they do. Doesn't need, like, a cartoon bad guy, Spider-People.
And I think Sorry. I think there's a way to present the Vorlon's understanding of the universe as pretty fucked up. That is lost in the way the shadows are talking, because what they're saying is, or what Morden and Justin are saying and Anna are saying, is like, don't you think the strongest races should live and other people should die? Which John's never going to say yes to. But another way to frame it is like, okay, here's what the Vorlons want. They're all about order. They have raised these other races to revere them and see them as gods.
Yeah.
So that they, as once they get rid of the shadows, they cannot be challenged in the universe or the galaxy or whatever as being in charge, being the strongest, most powerful race that calls the shots for all of the other races. They're trying to position themselves to be the permanent, like, galactic aristocracy. And the shadows' take is like, that is fucked up and manipulative. And shouldn't the way it works be that, you know, we are constantly kind of the way that a forest, when a fire burns down a forest, it fertilizes the soil. And it's like sometimes a cleansing fire is what's needed to get out all this dead brush and things like that so that a forest can regrow. And that's like the shadow ethos.
And like it kind of is, but the way that they explain it is not that.
Yeah. And like I'm not adding anything or changing anything about what they believe. I'm just presenting it in a way that I think John maybe would have stopped and been like, huh. Like the Vorlon approach is kind of tyrannical. It is their way is what's best and everybody else is going to fall in line. And that's it.
Yeah.
And I think the shadow pitch shouldn't have been like, their pitch to John was like, we have a problem with the fact that you've united everybody and we want you to break up that unity so that everybody kills each other. And he's not going to say yeah to that.
No.
But what he might say yes to is them being like, listen, we got to get rid of these Vorlon guys.
Yeah. Right.
Like use your federation of bros to
end the cycle, like get out of break cycle. Out of this.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
You know, and but because they're also just proposing another cycle, like instead of like your lives are dictated by gods, they're like, yeah, your lives are dictated by like the rules that define us, which are that we destroy each other and then we rebuild and get stronger and stronger until we're good.
Yeah.
Like, they're actually both parentalist in a way. One of their arguments is like, no, the Vorlons are parentalist. And it's like, no, both of these things are. Telling people this is the way life works is a little bit parentalist, which I think is the show's strongest criticism of religion, even though it is most more often than not definitely a very spiritual show and very, like, believing in the power of that faith and how it drives us. But this just felt like a lot of missed potential, and that's what's frustrating about it. But
yeah, it kind of... You know, it feels like the way that the shadows are positioning it is the Vorlons care about order and keeping people alive. Like, they care about peace and we care about war, which isn't quite right. I think a better understanding of the difference is that the Vorlons are religious and the shadows are secular.
There you go.
And so the Vorlons are about, like, hierarchy and purpose, and the shadows are about like pursuing. I mean, it comes down to their questions. The Vorlons, it's like, who are you? You have a fixed position in the order of the universe. Things are the way they are. There is like a caste system there, and you know, the Mimbari are kind of the perfect example of the ideal children of the Vorlons, where they have a society that is rigidly divided into defined by who you are. You are a warrior, a priest, or a worker.
Right.
And deeply traditional as a society, that feels in line with the Vorlons. And the humans kind of have some of that, but are kind of a shadow-esque species.
Mm-hmm.
Where what the shadows are pitching is like, let's live in a world where there aren't gods and where your position in life is not predetermined, but where the most important question is not who you are right now, but what you want.
Right. You just wrote a better... Ugh. He says it. That's what the question is.
Yeah. And like, it's right there, you know? But the agents of the shadows just don't pitch it very well.
Yeah, their pitch is... Their spiel is not good.
And I really think it was a missed opportunity to have a scene where the viewers really sit and are like, ooh, what are we fighting for here? Exactly. And it's a much more, to me, it's a much more interesting dichotomy to go religious secular than peace and war.
Right, because in that's one of the rare cases in morality where more often than not, there's a clear answer, which is peace. But if you're going to have that conversation, then you have to have people sell it better than, guys, what if the best races stayed alive? Wouldn't that be great? And the rest of them can just kind of, I don't know, be sacrificed. And I don't want it to just sound like we're bummed out. I mean, I am a little bit bummed out with this episode.
Yeah, but I'm a little underwhelmed. I think that's a fair critique.
But I think the end of the episode, specifically Jakar's narration and the, you know, constantly recurring imagery of the candles, gives me a little bit of hope that, like, they still know what works with this show and what's interesting. So his final narration, it's all about, like, the war and conflict and faith. And he has that line, nobody knows the future. We only know that it's born in moments of revelation and decisions. But to get there requires pain as we zoom in on the dark. Oh, and then we zoom in on, this is my notes now. We zoom in on the darkness of the shadows, and that's where the season ends. It's like, yeah, we're in it now. We're literally in it. But Jakar's being like, it is in our decisions that we define, that our lives are defined. It's not in the day to day. It's the moments where we choose things. So hopefully season 4 is a season about choosing, making choices and sticking to them.
Hmm.
I mean, it's called No Surrender, No Retreat. So,
yeah.
I mean, hope so. Let's hope.
The other thing, by the way, that was could have been explored more and was fucked up about the Vorlon stuff is when they were like, hey, John, why do you think telepaths appeared out of nowhere on Earth?
Yeah, they're just making their own weapons.
They did that because they need them to kill the shadows.
Yeah.
That was nuts.
That's
me.
Spooky.
Yeah.
I mean, that, remember when I said, like, when we first saw the telepaths in the ships, like, this seems like a really powerful image that they're not doing anything with? That is it. You're saying it. Like, we really just made people that are designed to be fodder, ammo.
Yeah.
And just, like, tying that back to the Vorlons is like, yes, the Vorlons and their methods are really messed up. Mm. Now give me an alternative. Yeah. That isn't also effed up.
Right.
So, I don't know, maybe even, like, the next season or two is going to be them realizing, like, well, the whole system is effed up and we need to govern ourselves. And it becomes a very, like, secular argument. I doubt it. I don't think the show is going to, like, make that strong of a pull, but who knows?
Yeah, we'll see.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's going to do it, man. That's going to be Babylon 5 Season 3.
Yeah.
Fun
pretty
one.
Good.
20.
Pretty good season, huh?
Yeah. Great season of television. Lots of highs. Not too many lows, but where they were, it was a bummer. And yeah. We've now passed the point of no return, and we enter No Surrender, No Retreat. So before we dive right into Season 4, next week on Chatsalon 5, tell the kids what we're doing, John.
Well, we're going to do what we do at the end of every season, and we're going to do a season recap episode. So on the season recaps, we generally will start by sorting the episodes of the season into different buckets based on if you're doing a watch or rewatch of Babylon 5, what are the most essential episodes you need to watch? What are the ones that you probably should watch because they're great? And then et cetera in different rankings.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll talk through that, and then we'll talk big picture themes and trends and thoughts about the season and predictions for the season to come. So that'll be fun. If you have anything that you want to say or have us say for you on that episode, please don't hesitate to reach out and send in your emails. We love, love, love emails, as you heard earlier in the show today.
Indeed. You can actually send those emails as we transition to the plug zone.
Yes.
To chatspod@gmail.com. That's chatspod@gmail.com. You can also tweet at us @chatspod if you don't feel like sending in an email. We love getting tweets and people following us there. You also get updates about the show and stuff if you follow us there. And if you are okay supporting us financially, we would love it if you could head over to patreon.com/chatspod. Over there, we're trying to break even on hosting the show. You know, it's very hard to host, but we really want to get to a point where this lovely hobby of ours is not also a financial difficulty or a negative. Like, it pulls on our funds, and that's hard. So patreon.com/chatspod. We do offer some fun bonuses if you back us there. At $2 a month, you get commentary chats where every month Magellan and I watch a movie and we talk over it. You can watch all sorts of movies with us. We watched Shrek. We watched Kung Pao. We watched Hook most recently. We watched a bunch of romantic comedies back in February. There's a large backlog. And then at $5 a month, you get Chats Nights, which is a every other week hangout show that we put out on Saturday nights where we just kind of talk. Sometimes it's like what we do before we record. Sometimes we'll just do a nights and then call it a night. And not end up doing anything else. And they're kind of run the gamut from stuff like we ask each other questions from our website that are like conversation starters, or we went through our Spotify list last year and talked about music, or we went through our Netflix queues recently. Just generally like fun, entertaining stuff. And fun thing about that too is you can actually, if you are a backer, you can request that we experience some form of media and talk about it. We actually have a listener who recommended us some reading recently that we're going to talk about. So you can do that. You can make us do stuff. It's cool.
Oh, yeah.
And then we don't usually do our own personal plugs since social media is a fuck. So Magellan, what's your chatsum for this week?
My chatsum for this week is a bit of a spot of music. I don't think it's secret that I adore the music of Carly Rae Jepsen. I strongly believe that her album Emotion is one of the greatest pop albums of all time. And I will fight you with words if you disagree. And you know what? Her follow-up that was released this past week, Dedicated, is also really good. So I highly recommend it. Give it a listen. Check it out.
Yeah, man. It's very fun.
Very fun. Like a little horny, but in kind of a nice way.
That's her brand. A little horny, but in a nice way.
Mm-hmm. What about you?
Yeah, I don't know how this keeps happening, but I also have the same type of chatsum as you this week. We are the same person. Basically, we're split apart at a young age. So mine is more of a recommendation of just an artist's oeuvre in general. Mm-hmm. Raleigh Ritchie, real name Jacob Anderson. Grey Worm on Game of Thrones, if you're into that sort of thing. He's a musician. He does, I'd say, more in the realm of like R&B is his sort of genre.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he has this song that has helped me through a lot of difficult times recently. It's called Time in a Tree. And it's got a beautiful video, and it's a beautiful song. And he actually did a video on Genius on their YouTube channel where he like talks about the lyrics. I love those like artists describe their lyrics videos on Genius. They're very entertaining, even if it's like an artist who you've never heard of talking about a song you never heard of, and you're like, oh well, your process is fascinating. He just seems like a really earnest, nice guy who is a very hard worker, and he has a lot of good music out there. So if you like Time in a Tree and you just want to listen back, he's got a whole album from 2016 that's very good, and he's putting out a new album soon. So
cool,
he's doing good things. Get on the train.
Cool.
And let's get off this train, and thank you for listening to this episode of Chatsalon 5. Peace.